Hey everybody, this is Tim Chavez from Faith Matters. Before we get into today's episode, we just want to mention that both the introduction you're about to hear and the conversation itself contain straightforward descriptions of violence. We wanted to give you a chance to consider that for anyone listening in before we go ahead. In September of 1857, one of the greatest atrocities in the history of Mormonism was carried out. Now known as the Mountain Meadows Massacre, a group of Latter-day Saints led a siege in southern Utah against a wagon train of emigrants on their way from Arkansas to California. After the siege had dragged on for several days, and under the guise of a truce, leaders of the Mormon Party lured the emigrants out of their protective circle of wagons and marched them a short distance across the valley before turning on them in surprise and slaughtering at least 120 unarmed men, women, and children. The details of this evil are difficult to talk about at all, much less dive deep on, but at the same time, historians Richard E. Turley and Barbara Jones Brown believe that it's important that we confront history, even its most difficult episodes, with as much honesty and depth as we can. As it pertains to history, Rick says we should drink deeply or drink not at all. Rick has served in many roles at the church over many years, including as managing director of the Family and Church History Department and managing director of the Public Affairs Department. Barbara is the director of Signature Books Publishing and former executive director of the Mormon History Association. Rick and Barbara are also the authors of a new book called Vengeance is Mine, The Mountain Meadows Massacre and Its Aftermath, which is the second in a two-volume series of exhaustively researched masterworks on the subject. The first book, Massacre at Mountain Meadows, on which Rick was one of the authors and Barbara was a content editor, was published in 2008, and this second volume is the culmination of over 18 years of research, writing, and editing by countless contributors. Though brilliant historians have written about the massacre before, these books include new research from documents and records that have never before been available. As we spoke with Barbara and Rick, we were struck not just by their comprehensive knowledge of these tragic events, but by the depth of their empathy for the victims and insights about how knowledge of difficult history can be a part of a larger story of healing and reconciliation. They and many others have been important in spearheading efforts in recent years to allow for that healing, including working with the church itself and organizations of victims' descendants. In fact, Henry B. Eyring credited the work done on the first book in 2007 in an official statement given at the site of the massacre on its sesquicentennial. As part of that statement, he said, "What was done here long ago by members of our church represents a terrible and inexcusable departure from Christian teaching and conduct. We cannot change what happened, but we can remember and honor those who were killed here. We express profound regret for the massacre carried out in this valley 150 years ago, and for the undue and untold suffering experienced by the victims then and by their relatives to the present time." What we hope for this episode is what we think Barbara and Rick hope for their book, that it can promote the same work of at-one-ment that is at the core of the gospel by fully acknowledging the sins of the past, actively listening and working toward healing in the present, and looking forward to a future of deep relationship and connection. Thanks as always for listening, and with that, we'll jump into the conversation.
Well, Rick and Barbara, thank you so much for being here with us. We've been so looking forward to talking to you both.
We've been excited to come. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you. You have both been working on Mountain Meadows for so long. Will you talk about how you started researching the massacre and when and how this project came to be?
So I don't know when I first learned about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, probably in my childhood at some point. But I certainly knew about it by high school and in college. And when I became the managing director of the church historical department at the ripe old age of 29 in 1986, We were beginning the process of negotiating with the relatives of the victims and the relatives of the perpetrators, as well as the state of Utah and the National Forest Service, to erect a monument on what's called Dansill Hill. That monument was dedicated in 1990. And around that time, I was invited to write an article about the Mountain Meadows for the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. So I've been writing about it for more than three decades. So as we were working on this monument, sentiment arose that we ought to have another monument. There was a 1932 monument built in the valley, and it was running down, and President Hinckley visited and thought it needed to be upgraded. So he called a meeting with the descendants of the victims and myself and several others and talked about replacing the 1932 with a new monument with a new one, which we did in 1999. And around that time, I got to thinking, we ought to write a book about this. As the person in charge of the church historical department, I was bothered by this idea that somehow or another church history should be taboo or that it should be somehow considered dangerous or something that you don't want to go into. Because people would ask me all the time, so is studying church history dangerous? And I'd say, no, studying not enough church history is. And I'm thinking of, you know, Alexander Pope's statement that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Drink deeply or drink not at all from the Perean spring. And he describes how when you take that for the Perean spring was a spring in Macedonia where basically the muses gave you, you know, the power to understand things. And Pope's essay basically says when you first start drinking of it, you get drunk. But with more drafts from the spring, then things clear up. And that's the way history is to me. It's a gigantic, it's like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle. When you first get a few pieces and set it up there and it looks weird, you think this is bizarre. But when you put all the pieces together, it may not be what you originally expected, but it is a remarkably clear and breathtaking type of landscape that you can look at. So I got to thinking, well, if we're going to get rid of that sentiment, what can we do? And I thought, well, we're already tackling the worst event in church history, why don't we do a book on it and have that book be completely open and honest? And so, candidly, I went to church leaders and I said, want to do a book. And it has three requirements. Number one, we let the chips fall where they may, no matter who they hit. Number two, we as authors retain full editorial control. It won't go through correlation. And number three, we get everything the church has on this subject, including what was denied to Juanita Brooks in her Mount Meadows Massacre book. Church leaders talked about it and said, sure, go for it. So
were you surprised?
I was not surprised because I developed in the 5 or so years I've been working there, I developed a relationship of trust with them. And so we started to work on the project, invited first Glenn Leonard and then Ron Walker to be part of it. And then we built a whole staff of people who went out all around the country. We ended up doing research in 31 of the 50 US states and 3 of the National Archives facilities. And along the way, Barbara came into the picture.
So my background with Mount Meadows, it coincidentally, about in 1990 or shortly thereafter, when the Dansell Hill Monument that Rick described was being dedicated, I was a return missionary. I had graduated from BYU. I was a seminary graduate, but I had never heard of the Mount Meadows Massacre. And one day, so my dad was really into church history and he had all kinds of church history things and Americana things hanging on the walls of our family room. And one day there was a fold-out image. It turned out to be a fold-out image from Harper's Weekly, 1877. And it was just framed and hung on the wall. And I'd always seen it for years, but never looked closely at it. And one day I was home from my mission, visiting home in Arizona, and I looked and I saw that there were men with guns walking alongside men who didn't have guns and some wagons. And then I looked closely in the corner and then there were some stereotypical kind of racialized images of Native Americans in the corner, kind of creeping, looking in and holding knives. And I thought, what is this? And then at the bottom, it said Mountain Meadows. And so I asked my dad, what is this? What was Mountain Meadows? And my dad said, well, honey, in 1857, a group of Mormons in Southern Utah wiped out a California-bound emigrant train, men, women, and children. And I felt like I'd been punched in the gut. Just, it took the wind out of me. I was so stunned because I had only heard just the heroic, wonderful stories of our pioneer ancestors. So to hear that some of our pioneer forebears had done something like this, I was shocked. And I said, well, why? And Dad said, nobody really knows, honey. There was rumors that these people had poisoned a spring and had the gun that killed Joseph Smith. And I said, so? But he's like, yeah, nobody really knows. So that is like that image or that experience was always in the back of my head. So I always hope to learn more about it someday. And that was back in 1990. In 2005, I had submitted the year before, really, a resume to the church history department and said, if you guys ever have any openings, I was a professional editor and I was really interested in getting into editing more church history. If you ever have any freelance work, I had a little baby at home, let me know. Well, I didn't hear anything for about 6 months. And then all of a sudden, I got a phone call from this guy and said, I'd like you to come in and interview for a position, an editing position with the Church History Department. And
I'm going to interrupt her just temporarily here. I'll tell you why I was impressed by Barbara. Barbara had a stint as an editor in the church magazines.
With the Ensign. Yeah, I did the news pages.
And in my various roles at church headquarters, I sometimes ended up in the Ensign magazine. And she was the only person who called about articles that were being published to check the facts with me. And I thought, now that's a sharp person who wants to make certain that an article is factually correct before publication. So she had that going for her before she even came in.
And I should say about Rick, I was always impressed with Rick because he was the only managing director who would take my calls when I called to check up on the accuracy of the articles I was writing. So we were just having phone calls back and forth that never met. So I get this phone call from Rick. I'd like you to come in and apply for this interview for this editing position. And we had just found out we were expecting our second baby. So the timing was not great for me to go back to full-time work. So I just said, oh, is it full-time, part-time? He said full-time. And I said, I can't do it from home. No. So I was like, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, I want you to edit my book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And I said, I'll be right in. And while I was sitting in there in the interview, I felt overwhelmingly, it did not make any sense for me in our timeline right then, but I was meant to take this job.
Wow. So just to clarify on how the book was created originally. So the church was on board with this. In fact, it sounded like, well, there's authors, there's editors, there's a research team. This is funded by the church.
Church is providing funding for research teams. It's providing basically funding for all the people who are contributing in some way to the research or the writing of it, with the understanding that the church is not going to edit it.
Yeah.
So we were living in the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Candidly, it's impossible to do the type of deep, cutting-edge research that we do if you're just the sole proprietor, individual academic at a university. Because even then, unless you get incredible funding, you know, some big, huge grant, you're just not going to be able to go as deep as we needed to go.
Yeah.
So we had the best of all worlds. We had the funding to do what needed to be done, to look into the worst event in the history of the church, to shine a huge spotlight into this corner where people had, you know, previously been trying to keep it shadowy, with also the understanding that we could then publish it as it was without any effort to try to correct any of that.
Yeah, so this doesn't go through correlation.
No way.
I think it's really impressive that the church backed it in this way. And I think that's important to people because there could naturally arise some suspicion if the church had any editorial control that the narrative is going to be crafted in a particular way.
And candidly, that goes back to an event that happened in the 1950s. Gordon B. Hinckley was a young apostle at the time. His father was a historian and writer in his own right. Juanita Brooks had published her book in 1950, and so the topic, which had been taboo in many quarters, was now being discussed among intellectual people around the church and around the world. They both had read the book and knew about it. President Hinckley's father wanted to see the site where the 1932 monument was, so they went there. And President Hinckley later talked about it, and he said, you know, we stood there, the wind was blowing, and we watched the site, and we felt this feeling of reverence for what had happened there. And I think at that moment, he committed to himself, if I ever have a chance to do something to bring about some healing on this, I'm going to do that. When he became church president in the 1990s, this was right at that moment we were building the monuments and working with descendants of victims and the perpetrators. And so he did everything that he could think of to try to bring about this type of reconciliation. And I will tell you, in talking to his family, to his children who have survived him, they have told me that late in his life, they took him to the Mountain Meadows. And as he was walking away by himself, kind of under his breath, they heard him mumble, well, I've done everything I can think of for them.
Yeah.
So having his backing from the beginning, I wasn't about, you know, the New Testament talks about if you're going to build a tower, consider the cost before you start to build it, lest you get partway through and you can't finish it. I thought, I want to tackle this project. I want to tackle it really, really well. But I don't want to get halfway through it and then have it be somehow or another scuttled. So that's why I went to the top to start with. And having his backing and all of the church leaders' backing from the beginning made it possible.
Wow.
Maybe we could jump ahead a little bit on talk about President Hinckley,
yes,
because I thought of this. So jumping ahead, after book one came out, which was called Massacre in Mount Meadows, the book we've just written is called Vengeance is Mine, the Mount Meadows Massacre and Its Aftermath. But after book one came out, and as we were working on book one, we became more deeply involved with reconciliation efforts with descendants of victims. Eventually, they came forward, the Mountain Meadows Monument Foundation and other descendants groups came forward and said, we would like to see the Mountain Meadows permanently protected. And they said we would like National Historic Landmark status. So we started working with them. We worked alongside them to achieve that.
Were you like the
that.
Church?
Rick and I, with the support of the church, and he can talk more about the church also helped fund purchasing more of the land to assure that the Mountain Meadows would be permanently protected. And when we went out to Arkansas to meet with our friends, it was a really moving meeting. And we announced that this was going to happen. They all jumped up and clapped. It was a wonderful healing moment of reconciliation. And one of the people there, his name was Scott Fancher. I remember he said, he said, I wish President Hinckley could have known about this because he had recently passed. And we said, President Hinckley approved the churches doing this. It was one of the last things he did before he died. So that kind of brings this story to full closure.
So when the Mountain Meadows Monument Foundation made the request of the church to have it be made a National Historic Landmark, and the two other Mountain Meadows related groups who had relatives of the victims, and then when they all came together and said, we want to do this, the First Presidency approved it. And then we talked to experts about how you get National Historic Landmark status, and it turns out to be not as easy as it sounds. They said, the experts said, you'll never get there in any short order unless you hire consultants who know how to do this. So the church paid for the consultants. Barbara and I worked with them. We filled out all the applications. It took us 2 years to get everything in order. And then at that point, the consultants said, okay, we're ready now to go to Washington and speak in front of a committee. And this is the most important hearing you're going to have. After that, it goes through other layers, but it's really the first committee that really makes the decision whether or not to pass it on. And that's the most important one. So at that point, we went to these three groups that represent the relatives, and we said to them, we're going to Washington. You need to send a representative who can provide your view on the Mountain Meadows. Now, Barbara and I were both church employees at the time. Of course, we would go back because we were trying to get this status for the Mountain Meadows. The state of Utah was going to send a representative back. Of course, there'd be federal people. But we needed a relative of the victims or someone to talk about the perspective of the victims. And they talked about it together. And I was surprised, humbled, and deeply honored when they said, Rick, we want you to represent us. So I sat down and I wrote a talk in which I described the Mountain Meadows from the perspective of those people who were killed. And then we all went to Washington, the heads of these organizations, and Barbara and I and others, and we made the presentation. And before the presentation, we went to an earlier session and listened to what happened. Almost every proposal that came up was turned down for further study. And then ours came up, and they listened to it. We gave our speeches, and they approved it on the first hearing.
Wow.
And afterwards, we were hugging and crying, and it was a feeling of peace and reconciliation because we'd done the right thing. And I want to tell you something that's not widely known about the church's efforts to acquire property at the Mountain Meadows. When I first came aboard in January of 1986, we only owned 2.5 acres around that 1932 monument. Southern Utah was booming with vacation homes, and there was an interest on a part of a lot of landholders in that area to subdivide their properties and start putting vacation homes
on. They were ranches. They were undeveloped ranches when we say property holders.
Okay. Yeah.
The first effort that we saw was an effort to take the view shed between Dan Sill Hill, where I think the two of you have been, and the monument in the valley, and put 1 acre ranchettes in there. And we thought, if you do that, you're going to destroy the view shed. People aren't going to be able to understand the massacre in the same way. But it would have been the easiest thing in the world for the church to just let that development occur. Mm-hmm. Then the Mountain Meadows monuments would have been these small little parks in the middle of a big vacation development. But instead, we recommended and church leaders approved paying to acquire those properties. We acquired over a mile square of property in various acquisitions. Wow. And then made that part of the National Historic Landmark. And that's occurred subsequently since then, acquired more property, added to the landmark. And what that makes possible is going to the Mountain Meadows today and being able to imagine the events in all of their atrocity that occurred there so that we don't forget what happened there.
And it's important to also acknowledge that the remains of the victims, they lie there. They are buried there. And so that's their burial spot. And so it is, you know, hallowed ground mm-hmm. for those people. So it was very important to preserve it for that reason as well.
Yeah.
Wow, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. We hope that everybody will read the books and or listen or something and really, because there is a reverence about the massacre that it's so horrific. And I know what you mean, that I feel like when you close the book, what you feel is this heavy reverence, and there is something peaceful about a reckoning that happens when you become a witness of the massacre and try to wrestle with what that means about who we are now. And so I hope people will read it. But I'd also love to just talk a little bit about the massacre itself. And something that was that I didn't really understand that was really helpful in the book was just understanding a little bit more about the political climate of the time. And the Mormon Reformation is kind of this peculiar little era in Utah history that is happening right in these couple of years. So can you just sort of set the stage and talk about the feeling among saints? Because I think like the narrative that I understood was that Salt Lake was, you know, the safe haven, and it was permanent, and everyone felt finally like they could relax a little bit and weren't being chased anymore. And so it was a really rude awakening to realize that they were completely prepared to keep running, and that maybe that was what was about to happen. So maybe just set the stage a little bit and talk about the political climate.
Sure. So as you mentioned, Aubrey, so in the prior decades, the Latter-day Saints had been driven from their homes violently in Illinois and Missouri. And so that's right. They come to the Salt Lake Valley in 1847. And then in 1857, they hear that President James Buchanan has sent troops to occupy the settlements, along with a replacement for Brigham Young as governor of the territory of Utah. So because of that background, obviously, fears arose, and they didn't know what the intentions of the troops are. They know what had happened before when troops came into their communities. And so they were very fearful about what was happening. So you have that going on. There's a certain war hysteria sets in. And then Young says, he writes in his diary, "I feel to be oppressed no more." And that's the mm-hmm. title of one of our chapters. Mm-hmm. But he's like, we're not going to be forced out again. We want to stay here. So they come up with various strategies in order to try and convince the federal government to pull back the troops and leave the Latter-day Saints where they have established their home. So you have that going on. You also have, as you mentioned, the Mormon Reformation, which was took place essentially between 1856 and 1857, in which Latter-day Saint leaders felt like some church members were losing their faithfulness and what we would say their activity in the church. And so they were preaching very strong sermons. They're described by Wilford Woodruff as like pitchfork tines raining down on the people, trying to awaken people. And so you have a lot of violent rhetoric in some of these meetings. Now, Brigham Young isn't counseling people to go out and massacre people, of course. But all of these factors kind of come together in a perfect storm that eventually lead to what is a war atrocity. The Utah War did ensue. And so that's all those things came together to lead to this horrific atrocity.
Could we talk a little bit more about the, sure. I mean, the big question for, I think, a lot of people that just sort of tangentially know about this event is why this particular wagon train? You know, what it's men, women, and children.
Yes.
Like how could even in a climate of fear and, mm-hmm. you know, scattered violence, how could something like this have actually come to be? And I think it's important to understand maybe some of those particularities.
Sure. So one of the things that we kind of discovered more, if you will, or dug into more with volume 2, which focused on the aftermath of the massacre, was the fact that there was another wagon train which had been attacked simultaneously. They were under siege simultaneously near Fillmore and Beaver, that area, when the emigrants at Mount Meadows were under siege at the same time. So it's like, oh, if
also they're... Also by Latter-day Saints in Fillmore, you're saying?
Yes. Latter-day Saints and Native Americans who were participating, who the Latter-day Saints had convinced to join with them in these in these cattle raids. So you're looking at, and you're like, well, if two are going on at the same time, then certainly this one wasn't being singled out. So the one train that I mentioned, we call them the Turner Dukes train in our book. They are attacked again on October 3rd, a few weeks after the massacre. And then we kept looking and we found raids on cattle companies in northern Utah within the same 3-week period. So clearly not one train was singled out.
Yeah.
Something went awry with the group at the Mountain Meadows.
Talk about
that led to that.
Yeah. Sorry, Rick, go ahead.
So a lot of members of the church have heard Lott Smith lionized for going out during the Utah War and attacking government supply trains. Sometimes members don't realize that those government supply trains are really civilian trains that are supplying the army. So they're not military people. They're civilian supply trains. And so part of Brigham Young's strategy was to try to slow down the troops. Hence, you know, Lott Smith and burning the wagon trains and so forth. And part of it was to give Washington a rationale for keeping the Saints there. And to that end, he called through his interpreter, Lott Huntington, he called in various Native groups and said to them, you can take cattle on the road south or the road north. And so they began to raid companies. And the idea was that Brigham Young was saying to Washington, look, without our help, you're going to find emigration is going to have to stop across this very, very important artery. And so there were these companies being attacked. Now, at the same time—
So Brigham Young, to be clear, is playing both sides of this.
He is.
Okay. He's now, encouraging—
He's encouraging the raids on the cattle in order to help Washington understand that they need the Saints in Utah. Yeah.
And he's playing on— It's important to point out, too, that he's playing on 19th century stereotypes of savage Indians, which are false. Mm-hmm. But he definitely played on that stereotype to create fears of, if you pull the Mormons out, if you drive us out of Utah, then who's going to keep these trails safe from, quote, the savage type of Indians?
Now, now, one important principle that it goes throughout our book, it applies in this situation in 1857, and it applies at the end when John D. Lee decides that he's going to just go to his death, is a concept that you find in the Doctrine and Covenants about not shedding innocent blood. Mm-hmm. The Doctrine and Covenants says if you shed innocent blood, you basically forfeit the opportunity to go to the celestial kingdom. Brigham Young's very concerned about this. This is an environment of war, but he doesn't want to be guilty of shedding innocent blood. So in his journal in August, he wrestles with this.
Of 1857.
In 1857. He wrestles with this and he basically says, I do not want to be guilty of shedding innocent blood. So before any of our people do anything that's violent to the point of bloodshed, we want to make certain that we warn people in advance and do what we can to keep them at bay and then basically only shed blood while defending himself. So he puts that in his August journal. So he's encouraging people with letters that he's sending around the territory at this time, do not shed blood, in part because he knows that that's going to be a sin and a crime, and in part because he knows he's got an army on his doorstep, and they're just looking for a reason, potentially, to unleash violence on his people, and what better excuse than some type of bloodshed.
And he's also thinking about the Mormons' public image.
Yes.
Because, again, he hopes to convince Congress, to convince Buchanan to pull the troops back out. So he says, if we don't shed any blood in this conflict, it will give us great influence abroad. So what we would call today public relations, public affairs, that term didn't exist back then. He's thinking about that as well.
So what goes awry with the train at Mountain Meadows? That's your question, essentially. Yeah. And basically, violence of this type normally occurs, and sadly, it's occurred throughout the history of the world in almost all geographical locations, at least where there's sizable populations. It occurs when people feel unsettled. And in this particular case, the people of Cedar City had heard that one branch of the army had broken off and might be emerging from the mountains east of Cedar City at any time. So they were unsettled. Mm-hmm. In moments like that, they then hear rumors that begin to pass through. We know that even before the company got there, it was a cattle company, and Isaac Haight thought, well, we're going to get some cattle from these people. Why cattle? Because part of Brigham Young's strategy is if we get besieged by the army and have to flee into the mountains, there are two foodstuffs that are going to keep us alive. One is grain, especially wheat. If you keep it dry, it'll last for years, and they've been candidly, they've been talking about that for 10 years since they arrived in the valley. Keep your wheat stored. So he's saying, okay, let's get that wheat supply. And then the other thing he's preaching is cattle on the hoof. Your live cattle don't require refrigeration. So Isaac Haight seems to know about this policy. And so when he hears that this cattle company is coming through, he says, okay, let's get some of their cattle. So when they come into town, they've somehow managed to get some wheat, and they go to the miller and they say, grind our wheat for us. He says, okay, that'll be one cow. Now, that's a really high price to just have a little bit of wheat ground. And so some other things happen that are very minor tensions, but they accelerate in Cedar City to the point that Isaac Haight, the stake president, the mayor, the militia major in town, he writes to his military superior in Parowan and says to him, I want to get the militia together, the Nauvoo Legion, and I want to surround these people because of the wrongs that they've done. Now, they're very, very minor wrongs, if they were wrongs at all.
I don't think they're wrongs at all. Yeah,
and just that they're perceptions, okay?
Conflicts, yeah.
And so he writes to William Dame. William Dame looks at it objectively and goes, no. You know, words are but wind. You might have had a little exchange of language, but words are but wind, let them go. At which point, Isaac Haight decides, okay, if I can't do this officially, I'm going to do it unofficially. So he'd had experience with John D. Lee and knew he was a strong man. He was the head, basically the head citizen down at Fort Harmony. He calls him up. They have an all-night event at the home that's under construction in Cedar City. And basically, Haight sends Lee out to do what he can't do officially, to do it unofficially, send him out. He wanted him to wait until the company had left the Mountain Meadows and gone down into the valley of the Santa Clara River, where it'd be easy to attack them more easily and drive off cattle. But Lee gets out there, and in the meantime, Haight calls his council together on Sunday, which was kind of a combination high council, town council. You know, they talk about herding and fencing and church stuff. And he says, well, I've sent John DeLee out to do this. And his local council members, they don't sustain him. They say that's wrong. So Haight sends out two men to call off Lee, thinking he's got plenty of time because they're not down into the Valley of Santa Clara yet. But Lee decides with his group on Monday morning, we're going to attack. Why wait? You know, we're just wasting time. Let's just go ahead and attack them. So they do attack them. And the problem is people die in the attack.
Yeah.
In fact, the first person to die is probably shot by John D. Lee.
Yeah, a herdsman that was asleep on the hill that Lee accidentally stumbles upon. Mm. And that's what makes this
But the goal, of this particular attack, yeah. just to be really clear for people that are unfamiliar, is this is not the massacre. This is
it's a cattle raid that goes awry. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the way it gets implemented is not the way that it's intended.
Yeah.
And you end up with, depending upon the sources that you look at, from a few people to over 10 people killed in that initial attack. The two people that Haight sends from Cedar City to call off Lee, they get down to Pinto, the area near Mountain Meadows, and they discover the attack's already happened. So then they panic. You know, now we've got to go back and tell him that we didn't get there in time, and even worse, you know, people died. So they're going back, and they run into two of the emigrants who had been sent back to gather cattle that had, you know, when you're trailing cattle, you always get some that are lost. They're back there to gather loose cattle. These two men have no idea what's happened. The two men from Cedar City approach them and think, we got to contain the situation. So they shoot at them. They kill one. The other one makes it back to the wagon train and basically says, not Indians, it's white men. And that then becomes the justification that Haight uses to go to Dame and say, they know it's us. If they go to California, it's either our families or their families. We've got a group of military people coming from the east. If we have another group coming from the west, we're going to be caught in the middle. And so they made the horrible decision to wipe them all out to cover up the botched initial attack.
Yeah.
So Dame is the stake president.
In Parowan.
And he is also the highest ranking military official.
Yes.
So at that point, does this become a military operation?
Very much so. Yeah. So Haight is a militia major in Cedar City. So he's the highest ranking militia person in Cedar City. The highest ranking militia commander for the whole of Southern Utah is William Dame in Parowan. So Haight goes to him to get permission to call out the militiamen to go and carry out the massacre. So very much so. We should also explain, though, that if you were 18 or older, you were automatically in the militia.
Yeah.
So it's basically all the men. But if we looked at all of the militia people that were sent out to the Mountain Meadows, many of them were high-ranking militia leaders. So,
and did they understand who was in the train? Did they understand what they were actually being asked to do?
Some probably did. Some probably didn't.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for listeners to understand that today when we talk about militias, we think of these sort of rogue right-wing people out in the desert with automatic weapons firing them. And in the early era of the American experiment, the people who formed the Constitution and were the early members of Congress, they were concerned about a president going rogue. And they thought, okay, we're not going to have a big army surrounding the president because he could go rogue and oppress all of us. So we'll have a small standing army. And then we're going to require by legislation, they passed two militia acts. By legislation, every male between the ages of 18 and 45 become part of a big people's army around the country. And if anything bad happens, if the president goes rogue, they can all rise up and put the president down. And so you have militias in every state and territory, and the one in Utah is called the Nauvoo Legion. So this is not some rogue group. This is part of the official American system. It later morphs into what we today call the National Guard.
Okay. So then at what point is word sent to Brigham Young?
So in that council meeting that Rick mentioned, the Sunday before the first attack.
The raid.
On the train.
Raid.
Yeah. So that takes place on September 7th. So the day before September 6th is when this council meeting is held in Cedar City, and Haight decides to send an express leader to Brigham Young to ask what they should do about the situation.
And up to that point, the situation is just that there is a wagon train moving through.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that letter does not survive. We know it exists because some people saw it and they wrote about what they said it said. Mm. But what they wrote, and these are contemporary sources that they saw that it said, was that there were some emigrants at the Mount Meadows. There were some problems and asking what to do about them, some California-bound emigrants.
And then is there a scholarly consensus that Brigham Young says, stop, like, don't do anything, let them pass? Is that something that's debated?
So in today's world, I would say that question's largely settled. But within the last 20 to 30 years, there has been scholarly debate. So let me sort of represent both sides of that. Okay. There's one side that says, oh, yeah, that would be really easy for Brigham Young after the fact to write this letter saying, let them go.
Dated September 10th.
The day before the actual message.
Right. Just create a paper trail. Yeah,
create a paper trail.
Exactly. That was a fake letter to cover himself that he wrote later.
So there have been some people who have argued that position. We've had access to the original materials. In the early days before there were photocopiers, there were letterpress copybooks. Letterpress copybooks were these bound volumes of onion skin. And when you wrote a letter while the ink was still wet, you would moisten the pages of the book. You would put the letter in it and you put it in a book press and screw it down. And the ink from one side would transfer to the onion skin. It would give you what looks like a mimeographed copy, if you're old enough to know what a mimeograph is. And so we went back and we said, is this letter in its correct position with all the correspondence from the time? Oh. And it is.
This is research that you two did for
Well, and I think like generally people have known this, that, I mean, that knowledge has been around for a while, but
I think not everybody's known it, which is why they say, well, it could have been created later, but there it is in its correct sequence.
In the correct sequence.
There's no problem with the binding. Nothing's been, it is clearly written on September 10th.
Yeah. And he says, let them, if those who are there will go, in other words, if they are willing to move on, which shows he doesn't know the full story, but he just says, let them go in peace. You must not meddle with them.
The other thing he says is that, look, we've gotten word that the army's not as bad as we thought they were going to be. They aren't going to reach Utah.
There's 850 instead of 2,500.
So he's basically trying to amp down the energy on this.
Like, contextually, it makes sense that he wouldn't have wanted something like this to happen.
And so what's interesting is in that same letter that we're talking about, he also says the Indians will do as they please. That goes back to this, strategy of, I'm not going to hold the Indians back anymore. Again, playing on these stereotypes that we don't subscribe to today, right? Yeah. But playing on those stereotypes, saying, if you pull the Mormons out, I'm not going to hold them back, the Indians anymore. They're going to start attacking and raiding Caltrain. So he says the Indians will do as they please, but you must not meddle with them. Let them go
privately, he sent interpreters to say, go ahead and do these ways.
He's encouraging.
Not just that we'll be hands off, but there's an encouragement. Yeah.
The challenge with that is that Jacob Hammond is the president of the Indian Mission. He's got a home in Santa Clara. He's got a home at the Mountain Meadows. He's in Salt Lake. The book begins with him in Salt Lake with a plural wife being married by Brigham Young.
Priscilla Lovett.
He brings up with him the major native leaders of Southern Utah. And they come to a meeting in Brigham Young's office, and he tells them this. You can have this. But we have no evidence any of them made it down there.
It wouldn't have been these same Indians that were in Young's office on September 1st.
And in fact, later on, when the participants tried to justify this by saying, well, it was all Indians and there were hundreds of them, that's simply not true. One of the participants in the massacre says in his trial testimony later on that there were no great chiefs there, meaning that the ones that had been taken by Jacob Hamlin up there had not made it down yet.
Okay.
So the exact connection between Brigham Young saying you can have all the cattle on the road south to these Indian leaders and what happens at Mountain Meadows is unclear. Did Isaac Haight sort of get general word of it ahead of time? Possibly. We just don't know for sure.
Okay. That's so really helpful, because it seems like the Paiute are also victims in this story.
Absolutely. They're victims in that. So the way I try to explain this is 50 to 60 white militiamen participated, right? They do not represent the whole Latter-day Saint population, of course. And we do not know the exact number of Indians who participated, but it's a very small number compared to their entire population. And so we have in our book accounts of Paiutes who say, no, I'm not going. I'm not going out there. So there were many that declined to go, that did not want to participate. There were some that there were oral histories of some that just watched it and said, oh, we're going to get blamed for it. And then there's other early accounts as well, multiple early accounts that there were some that did participate. So, but the tragedy is that the plan was from the start to lay this all on the Indians, to blame it on them. And that is what happens. And they bear the burden. The local Paiutes bear that burden for generations. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing we hope our book does, is to show who truly planned, orchestrated, and largely carried out this crime using some of them were probably baptized Latter-day Saints themselves, their local Indian brothers and brothers to help join in this, so they could blame this on them. So that there's a form of victimization there as well that we hope to clear up.
Yeah. Let's maybe finish out the narrative from the time where the man escapes, who is trying to gather the cattle, and goes back, rejoins everyone else as part of who is in the wagon train, and says, no, this was not Indians. This was white men. That's September 7th?
Yeah, he gets back in probably September 7th or 8th. Okay. We don't know the exact date on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you just tell the rest of the events through September 11th and what
sure.
happened?
Sure. So again, as Rick was explaining, so you have a witness now that gets inside of the wagon corral sharing white men are involved. So this was a common practice, and it must have been in like guidebooks and things, because it happened over and over again with attacks. Yeah. So if wagon trains came under attack from Native Americans, the what they did was they would quickly circle their wagon. We still have that expression today, circle your wagons, right? Quickly circled your wagons. They would chain the wagon wheels together, and then they would dig pits inside of them from which they could hide and like shoot. And so that's what happens after that first initial attack on September 7th. They circle their wagons and dig in. And then they send a few people, one to California, some back towards Cedar City to seek help. Those people that go for help, they're all killed.
Yeah. Essentially, this wagon corral is under siege by Mormons still at this point.
Exactly.
So as people try to escape, they're shot.
So they make the horrible decision, as Rick was saying, to call out the militia, because they think, oh, we've got to wipe out all the witnesses. There's another wagon train that's coming behind them. And if they come on the scene, on the trail, and see this, then you have even more witnesses. So they're thinking cover up. Mm-hmm. So they decide to wipe out these witnesses inside. The militiamen are called out, sent to the meadows. They arrive sometime in the middle of the night, Thursday, September 10th, and early morning, September 11th. They're told what they're going to do. They go and they line up along the trail outside of the wagon corral. William Bateman and John D. Lee, they bring their own white flag, walk towards the wagon corral to signal that they're there to help them.
Which is part of the treachery.
Which is part of the horrific treachery. And then they allow John D. Lee inside their wagon corral. He says, we're here to save you. We're here to protect you. We're going to lead you back to the settlement safely. And they say, he says, the Indians are mad at the men because some of them have been killed in these initial attacks. And of course, these debates are going on inside. You have some of the emigrant men, they're saying, no, you're crazy. This is treachery. They doubt it. But they also are so desperate. They've used up all their ammunition over the past 5 days. Mm-hmm. They've been under siege. They also don't have water. And you can imagine the heat in the September sun and without access to water with countless and numerous children as well. So they are so desperate. They agree and they decide to trust Lee and these militiamen. So they turn over their guns. Their guns are placed inside of two Mormon wagons that they bring inside of the corral. And Lee directs that the two wagons leave the corral first. And in the back of the wagons are the youngest children and wounded, as well as guns. Then the women and children leave next. And then behind them, the men and the oldest teenage boys come out. When the men and oldest teenage boys line up along the trail next to the militiamen, each who are carrying a gun, they cheer for them. They think that they are there to rescue them. And the whole procession begins to walk northward out of the mountain meadows. At a given spot about a mile north where there is thick sagebrush and oak that grows right around the trail, a number of Native Americans are hiding there, directed by Nephi Johnson, who is an interpreter. He speaks Paiute. And at a given signal, the men in the militia line, they turn to the emigrant men at their left and shoot them in the head. A few run off and they are chased down by men on horseback and their throats slit. And then Nephi Johnson gives the signal for Indians to rush out where they've been hiding and kill the women and children. The white militiamen go forward and they help to continue to kill the women and children. Anyone they find that is not dead yet, they shoot in the head. They kill all of the children who are considered too old to tell tales. The oldest two children who are spared are only 6 years old. Most of the children who are spared are age 2 and under. It's a horrific crime.
And let me add to that. Sometimes when people tell the story, they say, well, the company was made up mostly of women and children. And since the Paiutes and others who were up there were responsible for killing the women and children, then most of the killing was done by Indians and not by the white men. The white men just shot other men, and that was all part of battle. This is some of the rationalization that you hear. But Nephi Johnson, who was racked with guilt from that moment for the rest of his life, late in his life, when he's trying to get this burden of guilt off of him, he approaches a Latter-day Saint apostle. And remember, he's the one that's the interpreter up there with the Paiutes. And he confesses to him, white men did most of the killing.
And so at this point, it's so hard to imagine what they were thinking. Like, what did it feel like? It just got out of hand. It doesn't feel like a crime of passion, right? Like, it was totally premeditated.
Very well planned. Yeah. Very well premeditated, very well planned so as to wipe out these people without losing a single Latter-day Saint, a single militiaman perpetrator. And it worked. It was just based on horrific treachery, false promises of protection to these desperate people.
So the question emotionally is, how do you deal with this when you're a perpetrator?
Yeah.
And there were some who rationalized in their head that this was a military operation and they were just soldiers doing their duty as they'd been directed to do. John D. Lee goes up to the Mountain Meadows, rolls out his blanket, and sleeps like a baby. It's hard for me to understand how anybody could sleep after having participated in something like that. Others on the far end of the emotional scale were racked with guilt. Our book ends with Nephi Johnson's delirious ramblings about blood. And so, across time, people dealt with it various ways. Some just went silent. Oftentimes, when people are involved in trauma, even as a person who inflicts trauma, they go silent. And that happened to many of the people. Others came forward and talked about it. And one of the things that we want to talk about is healing intergenerational trauma. Because, you know, I spent 12 years as the managing director of the Family History Department. It was during the time we launched Family Search, and I went to a lot of national, international family history types of meetings. And what I learned, which is good, is that many people try to craft their own identity by looking at their ancestors. And that has a good side to it. You know, we can learn by passing on traditions. My wife has a Scandinavian ancestry, and every year we have a general conference event in which we cook evil skewers. It's just sort of a passed down tradition. There's nothing wrong with that at all. It helps pass down the Scandinavian roots that she has. But on the other hand, we think sometimes people try to create too much of their identity by trying to rehabilitate their ancestors and make them all perfect. Mm. The reality is that all of our ancestors were human, which presupposes that they had weaknesses, and some even did horrific things. We sometimes think of a pedigree chart as this nice little angle that goes out and nobody's really interconnected. I know from my research doing family history that you get out a little bit and it all messes together. It looks more like a DNA helix, okay? Yeah. It's all interconnected. So if you take the number of people who were perpetrators of the massacre, 50 to 60, and you look at the polygamous relationships many of them had and the number of children, you go down through the generations, and then you look at the intermarriages that occurred among pioneer Latter-day Saint families over time, many people who do their genealogy are going to find out that they're descendants of these people who previously have only been described in their family circles as great heroes and heroines. So how do you deal with it when you discover that this is in your own line?
So Rick is passing the baton to me with this because after we had finished book one, after we'd been involved in all these reconciliation efforts, after Rick and I started writing Vengeance is Mine, I was looking at some family history and there was a last name that I recognized that was in our first book. And I said the name was Holly, and I was like, oh, well, there was a Holly in book one, and he was a good guy. He was someone who spoke against the massacre. Am I related to him? So I looked, and I was like, oh, no, he's my great-great-great uncle. I'm so proud to be related to him because he had spoken against the massacre. And then I was like, okay, well, who's my ancestor? And it was his brother, William. And so I'm like, okay, I wonder if William ever came out in our book. So I go to the index and I look in the appendix. William S. Holly was a perpetrator of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I was stunned, absolutely stunned. In fact, I even considered maybe taking myself off the project because I was too, close. But then I remembered Juanita Brooks is a direct descendant of a massacre participant named Dudley Levitt. So I stayed, mm-hmm. I stayed on. But so the reason I wanted to talk about this is since book two has come out, I've had, and Rick has too, so many people approaching me via social media saying, I'm a descendant of a perpetrator. I'm a descendant of a perpetrator. I'm a descendant of a perpetrator. I thought it was just a very unique experience to me. But then Rick was like, just brought up what he just said. There were 50 to 60 men, polygamous. There are probably countless thousands of us who have ties. We just don't know it. The only reason I figured it out was because I had studied the subject and I recognized a name. Yeah. So we all kind of collectively, whether we're related to a descendant or to a participant, or whether we're just Latter-day Saints and our fellow members of our church participated in this, collectively, we kind of all have a share in this horrible.
Yeah.
So we wanted to talk about how you heal from trauma. Please.
So one of the most important principles to remember is that no one alive today had anything to do with the Mountain Meadows Massacre. However, we are all responsible for how we deal with the subject. It is a natural human inclination to want to rehabilitate an ancestor who you've discovered has done something wrong. So people lapse into a mode of denial or an effort to try to justify what was done. And that is exactly the wrong approach. That will not bring about healing. That will not bring about reconciliation. If you talk to the descendants of the victims, they will talk about two major things that are important to them. Number one, that we tell the truth, that we acknowledge the story, and with that, express sorrow about what happened. To say, I'm sorry for what my ancestor did is an important part of healing if you're the descendant of a perpetrator. Number two, the bones of the victims still lie at the Mountain Meadows. We've had people approach us and say, why are you talking about this? Barbara was saying she read comments in a recent newspaper article.
Why are we talking about this subject again? Oh,
yeah. And my answer is to say, why do we continue to talk about Carthage? You know, if you live in Carthage, Illinois, the Carthage massacre, as it's sometimes called, is not your proudest moment. And yet, the people of Carthage, Illinois, allow us to talk about the martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram Smith, because it's very important to our story, our culture, and even our ancestry for some people. And so it is with the Mountain Meadows. We think it's a very positive healing thing that rather than let the Mountain Meadows property just sort of get consumed by development, the church purchased it and paid to have consultants come in and have it be made a National Historic Landmark. So rather than forget about it and deny that our ancestors were there, we can acknowledge it, learn from it, and grow. The reality is this. History is messy. I said a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Sometimes people go into the study of history thinking, oh, I'm going to discover all these wonderful things about my ancestry, my church, my nation, my cultural identity, my people, whatever the case may be. And you'll find things that are good and you'll find things that are not good. Some people are unable to deal with ambiguity. They're unable to deal with uncertainty. And history is all about that. So one of the most important things that we can do as members of the church is to recognize that messiness of history and learn how to deal with ambiguity and uncertainty.
And as it pertains to this particular incident, you've talked about descendants of perpetrators, but what if we zoom out one more level and say, just as church members generally, do we have a cultural or communitarian responsibility to remember this event and participate in the work of reconciliation?
Yeah, I think so. And as I mentioned, I encountered this story not knowing I was a descendant of a perpetrator, just knowing I was a Latter-day Saint whose people had participated in this. So that was very, very painful as well. But because I had studied it and understood it and was willing to grapple with the pain of encountering this, when I met descendants of victims, I was able to tell them, express to them my sorrow for what had happened. And I realized they had so much pain because of what had happened and they weren't hearing, I'm sorry. Wow. So when I was able to say, I'm so sorry for what my people did and your people did not deserve this, the reconciliation and the healing and ultimately the peace started to come. And just as collectively we can do that. And that's how Rick and I want to encourage people to, instead of saying, we don't want to talk about this anymore, why are we talking about this? That is never going to lead to healing and peace. It's 160 years later. That has never worked. What leads to healing and peace is encountering it, grappling it with it, owning it, expressing sorrow, and then reaching out to those on the other side, descendants of victims who are expressing pain, and that heals their pain.
Yeah. I know it's hard to make generalizations, but this keeps coming up for me. In your interactions with descendants of victims, obviously you have found pain, like you talked about. Is there still, in some cases, anger and suspicion, and it's been tough to find that reconciliation and healing?
As you can imagine, this type of intergenerational trauma is very, very difficult to get rid of. And it has a factual basis. You know, when you meet a descendant of a victim and they say, your people killed my ancestors, and they traumatized the surviving children from whom I descend, you can understand that there'd be a great deal of emotion surrounding that. But most of the relatives of victims that we've encountered are good, honest,
dear friends,
wonderful people, many of them deeply religious. And we have become, as Barbara said, dear friends with them. And they, you know, we communicate back and forth. Barbara and I have both been invited to speak at their events. We're speaking at an event this September, a commemoration, this one down in the Mountain Meadows area. Last year, I spoke in Arkansas in September. And many of the people came up to me afterwards because we essentially summarized our new book for them. And they said that they feel really good about our efforts to try to tell the truth. That's so essential for healing and reconciliation.
Yeah. And while we were working on book one, Rick and I and several others who were working on this horrendous story were experiencing symptoms similar to those who suffer PTSD have. We were just, you know, nightmares, like crying, just staring into the middle of, you know, I had two little girls at the time. I saw blood coming out. I mean, it was horrific what we were going through on book one. And I didn't know this would happen, but when I had some descendants of victims invite me to Arkansas to meet all of them at a reunion they were having in the spring of 2007, reenacting the 150th anniversary of their people leaving from Arkansas, and I met with them and I sat with their anger and I listened to their anger, which I was able to do because I understood the history and I was angry myself. And then I just told them how sorry I was. And the more people I told, and they would start crying and say, thank you. We just needed to hear that. All of a sudden, I felt better. I felt that was what finally got me over the horrific suffering I was going through. I felt better.
Did you know at that point about your ancestors?
I didn't know. Wow. No, I didn't know until after it was all over.
So we have to get over what I sometimes refer to as toxic perfectionism, not just individually, but this idea of toxic perfectionism in our ancestors.
Yeah.
And until we can get over that idea and accept them for who they were, we don't have to accept the wrongs that they did. We can perpetuate the good that they did, but we should not. Again, no one alive today is responsible for it, but we are responsible for how we deal with the topic. And the best thing that we can do is to seek the truth and to participate in efforts at healing and reconciliation.
So. It also feels like part of the reconciliation as a community must be that we figure out what values we can embrace to make sure that nothing like this could happen again.
Again, that's another reason why we feel it's so important to, yes, it is important to learn about this story so we don't repeat the mistakes of the past.
One of the causes of this type of violence is polarization when there are politically difficult times. So some people have compared this to a horseshoe. You know, initially everybody's sort of at the bend of the horseshoe. But then as times get tough, economically, politically, otherwise, sometimes they start to descend down the two ends of the horseshoe. And as they move down the two ends of the horseshoe, they become more and more willing to vilify the other side of the horseshoe. And then having vilified the other side, they begin to think about violence towards those people, even to justify the violence. And so we need to avoid extremism. Extremism is what causes this to happen. It's not religion. It's not atheism. It's extremism. Okay,
and
that's the ism.
Yeah, conflict can occur whether it's through religion, through its politics. It's conflict. So how do we avoid conflict? And it comes through seeing each other as humans, fellow humans. Mm. Yeah, seeking to understand each other. Yeah.
And the sad thing is, and Barbara has said this many times, if it had been any other year and any other time, those immigrants coming down through could have been friends with the very families that took them out. Yeah. They could have been cooking together, making quilts together.
Yeah, I mean, there was this polarization at the time, right? So the Latter-day Saints were demonized and by the rest of the nation. And so, you know, people at the time just saw Latter-day Saints as the other, you know. I mean, there was so much of that. And that with between white settlers and Native American groups, you know, there's so much of this going on in our country at the time. And we see it coming back, these kinds of feelings today, unfortunately.
And one of the points we want to make is that a lot has been made of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, which is an instance of whites killing whites and blaming it on Native peoples. But there have been many massacres of Native peoples that haven't received nearly that type of attention.
And far greater scale, far more people.
We talk about the Bear River Massacre in our book. Another big massacre that hasn't gotten sufficient attention is the Sand Creek Massacre. So I think it's important that we realize there have been many atrocities in history. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're an American, you need to somehow resign your citizenship, because you'll find, regardless of where you go, that history is messy and that people have done things that are wrong. Instead of looking at that and saying, oh, I'm ashamed to be an American, what we should say is, I want to learn from the past. Because if we don't learn from the past, we may do something that's very similar. Mm. Maybe today it's on social media. You know, maybe we vilify somebody on social media because we've heard some rumor about them. It turns out not to be true, but we end up destroying their life because we vilify them and get others to gang up on them. In retrospect, after 20 years, you might look back on that and say, I'm horrified that I would do that. Well, now's the time to think about it. Think about this book. Think about the people. Think about how they were polarized. Think about what they did with the polarization. Think about how they vilified the other. We should try to replace vilification with love. We name our book, Vengeance is Mine, for multiple reasons. But that is a slogan from the New Testament that is placed on the cross over the bones of the victims by the army that builds the cairn to them. And that same book of scripture that says, vengeance is mine, is essentially the Lord saying, do not wreak vengeance on others. That's my responsibility. And then he goes on to say, basically, feed your enemies. Be kind to them. So we should replace any type of feeling of animosity with feelings of love and tolerance.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so this vengeance is mine scripture is the title of our book. It's also the epigraph. And what it says, in fact, it was a descendant of victims that taught me this. But that's from Romans. And then two verses below that, it says, be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. And that's why we chose it for our epigraph. We hope our book does good, overcomes evil by just telling the truth and then learning from it and moving on.
So some people say, well, this is just an obscure story from southwestern Utah and we, you know, not important to us. Actually, it's a human story. These types of killings, as I mentioned earlier, occur throughout all of human history, throughout virtually all of the world. They will continue to happen unless we can learn the important lesson that Barbara just mentioned.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thanks for spending decades doing this for us so that we can participate in this reconciliation and healing. And there's so much more to the story that we won't have time to get to. So I hope people will read the book. There's so much more about the 17 children victims who are reunited with family and the trial of John D. Lee. And it goes on and on. And I'm sure there's more. You could probably do another book just about the, you know, what happens with the survivors. But thank you so much for what we've got and for your three decades of work. Is there anything else that you feel like we need to make sure to say before we wrap up?
I think just don't be afraid of history. We'll encounter some things that are troubling in our history, whether it's our nation's history, our church's history, our state's history. That's okay. don't be afraid of it. It's in the past, but we can learn from it and use it to make us better people when we encounter it.
Thank you. That's beautiful.
And to quote Alexander Pope again, drink deeply or drink not at all from the Perean spring.
Thank you both.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much for listening. And we want to send a huge thanks to Rick Turley and Barbara Jones Brown for coming on and for their incredible work on this new book. Vengeance is Mine is available now at Deseret Book and on Amazon. And as always, if Faith Matters content is resonating with you and you get a chance, we'd love for you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen on. It really helps get the word out about Faith Matters, and we really appreciate your support. Thanks again for listening, and as always, you can check out more at faithmatters.org.